Welcome to a deep dive into some truly unusual source material we have here.
Yeah, it really looks like it pulls back the curtain on a very specific way of telling stories, doesn't it?
It does. And it gives us a glimpse, maybe, into a story crafted using those exact principles.
So what we've got are these excerpts. They seem to lay out the production philosophy, kind of the rules, for something called Inspector Story.
Right, alongside this narrative called She Prayed for the Devil.
Exactly. It's like we're looking at the mechanics behind a certain type of horror, one that's trying not to feel like entertainment.
More like evidence. Something you maybe stumbled upon.
Precisely. Like a recovered document describing how to create this feeling paired with, well, it feels like an example case file.
Okay, so our mission for this deep dives, unpack these ideas, see what makes this style tick.
Yeah, and see how those ideas actually play out in that story, She Prayed for the Devil. What are the core ingredients here? What's the effect they're going for?
All right, let's dig into this production guide first. Mm-hmm. It really maps out a framework for horror that feels, I don't know, different. Less like a show, more like...
like a cursed audio file, maybe. It's like corrupted.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of vibe. So what are the big ideas setting it apart? What jumps out?
Well, what's really striking is how much it pushes back against, you know, typical horror stuff.
Like what?
Like jump scares, for instance. They explicitly say avoid them. The sources push this idea of grounded horror.
Grounded horror.
And paranormal realism. It sounds like an oxymoron. Mm. But I think it means making the strange feel disturbingly plausible, rooted in reality almost.
So not fantasy horror.
Right. It's about focusing on unseen mechanisms, the how and why behind the weirdness, rather than just showing you a monster.
Building tension through what isn't said, through silence, things being just slightly wrong.
Exactly. Things that are just subtly off. You can't quite place it, but you feel it.
So it's not the monster itself, but the shadow it casts.
Yeah.
And making that shadow feel unnervingly real.
That's a good way to put it. And the rules here are pretty strict, aren't they? Almost like a code.
They really are. Things like no parroting. Hosts shouldn't just echo each other.
Yeah, and they even suggest hosts might disagree sometimes or follow different trains of thought to make it feel more authentic, like real people grappling with it.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
And jumping straight in, no long intro, slow escalation, and this bit about avoiding overly emotional language.
Yeah, that's key. It's meant to feel raw, clinical almost, like you've intercepted something official, but deeply wrong, something not meant for public consumption.
A clinical feel. It connects to the language, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The language choice is critical for that paranormal realism thing. They specifically mention mixing forensic terms with haunting language.
Forensic terms, like?
Think recorded, archived, surveillance, log entry, case file. Applying these procedural words to something utterly supernatural.
Okay, I see. Treating the ghost story like it's evidence in a cold case file.
Exactly. But then you mix that with phrases like, the tape never blinked, or standing in the static, or last log ends with a knock.
Ah, so it's the contrast, the official language documenting something that defies official explanation, maybe recorded by someone who's getting unnerved themselves.
Precisely. It grounds the horror in bureaucracy, makes it feel inescapable, but also deeply personal and unsettling.
And then there's the atmosphere, particularly the sound. This bit really stood out to me.
Oh, yeah. The sound design principles are fascinating.
It's not about big, dramatic music cues or stingers. It's about minimal, unsettling stuff, like subtle distortion, low hums.
Right. Things that feel almost subliminal. And using silence, actual silent gaps, not as mistakes, but as moments of tension, like something's holding its breath.
Or listening.
Yeah.
And sounds aren't just background noise. They're clues, like a specific mechanical whirring or distant breathing.
Stuff that shouldn't be there. It's designed to like creep under your skin, bypassing your conscious brain. Horror you absorb through your ears, almost.
Which brings up a good point. If the horror is subtle, and the guide suggests characters should act rationally, not like typical horror victims, how do you create that dread?
That's a really interesting puzzle they seem to address. They suggest playing with psychological stuff, cracks in reality.
Like what?
Things like memory distortion. People forgetting things too fast, or maybe remembering something too vividly, unnaturally, clearly.
Or reacting wrong, like the wrong emotion for this situation.
Exactly. Not illogical necessarily, but like their perception is being subtly warped. And they also mention using unreliable transcripts.
Ah, like with redactions or missing bits or timestamps that don't quite add up.
Yeah. It creates that feeling of trying to understand something huge and maybe dangerous through incomplete, possibly compromised data, which is unsettling in itself.
They also list some specific psychological horror tools. Feels less like monsters and more like systems.
Definitely, like memory loops where someone's stuck reliving something. Or this idea of parasitic footage.
Parasitic footage, what's that?
The idea that the more you watch something, the harder it is to stop. And maybe it even starts to, like, change you, infect you.
Creepy. Okay, and pattern logic. Repeating numbers, names.
Yeah, hinting at some kind of unseen design or intelligence, and even bureaucratic horror.
Bureaucratic horror, like scary paperwork.
Sort of. Finding dread in forms, memos from departments you can't identify, rules that seem designed to trap you. It's not just a haunted house. It's being lost in a system, observed by something vast and indifferent.
A system with rules you can't even see.
Exactly. And connecting that to the bigger picture, the lore isn't about explaining everything. It's the opposite.
Right. It hints that everything is part of something bigger, like a cover-up, a system, maybe some kind of test.
Yeah. And entities aren't really described as monsters. They're called ambient, like a presence or a force that corrupts things rather than showing up dramatically.
So the focus stays on why. Why was this documented? What's the purpose behind this specific recording or file? Hinting at a bigger story you never fully grasp?
Precisely. It's all about that implication, that sense of an unsettling reality just beyond reach.
Okay, so that's the style they're describing. Grounded, subtle, psychological, bureaucratic, focusing on implication, using mundane details to create unease.
A very specific flavor of dread.
So now let's turn to the story they included. She prayed for the devil. Reading it, it does feel like one of these recovered files. It's concise, almost clinical, despite the subject.
It starts very simply, doesn't it? 2005, Tijuana, a 7-year-old girl, Sophia, and her nightly prayers.
Yeah, and the source says her mother overheard one specific prayer that just hits you.
God bless Mama, God bless Papa, God bless my brother. Normal enough.
But then, and please bless Lucifer too, because no one ever prays for him.
Wow. Yeah, it's a innocent child logic applied to something incredibly dark. And her reason.
Because he's lonely. It just reframes everything, doesn't it? Portraying this ultimate evil figure through a child's empathy for loneliness. It's unsettling because it's so unexpectedly innocent.
It really sets a strange, uncomfortable tone right away.
So what stands out to you next? For me, it's how abrupt and frankly brutal the next event is.
The accident.
Yeah. Sophia's hit by a car, dies instantly. There's no foreshadowing, no dramatic lead up. It's just sudden real world tragedy.
And then the detail about the family not being able to afford a proper burial, that really grounds it in that painful, mundane reality.
Absolutely. It feels very much in line with that grounded horror idea. The mix of heartbreakingly real hardship right before the truly weird stuff happens.
It's a stark contrast, mundane tragedy, than this surreal intervention.
At the funeral itself, amidst all that grief and stress.
This tall, pale man shows up, black suit, says nothing, just watches.
Doesn't offer condolences, nothing.
And then he just hands over a signed check, covering everything, every single expense.
An unbelievable act of generosity, but from this deeply unsettling figure. And when the mother asks him why,
his answer connects directly back to that prayer. Chillingly simple. She was the only one who ever prayed for me.
And then he's just gone, vanishes into the haze or the crowd. The source is a bit vague there.
Which adds to the mystery. And the check signed with just one letter.
Yeah, there.
Yeah. And the aftermath described, it really cements the unsettling vibe. It spreads beyond the family.
The priest refuses to talk about it afterwards. The funeral director quits.
And maybe the eeriest detail. Nothing grows near Sophia's grave.
It just piles on these strange, unexplainable details. The kind that stick with you, you know?
Yeah.
No easy answers. Forces you to just sit with the weirdness.
And there's that extra layer from the local claims. People reportedly seeing the same man.
Kneeling at her grave. Late at night.
Yeah, apparently muttering silent prayers. It suggests it wasn't just a one-off thing. There's a persistent connection. He's still tied to that place, to her.
And the story ends with Mother's final thought, which just throws another curveball.
The source gives us this line, some angels fall, but maybe some just want to come home.
It's so darkly poetic and ambiguous. It doesn't explain who he was, but hints at something much more complex, maybe even tragic, than just pure evil.
It leaves you with questions, right? About loneliness, maybe redemption, the actual nature of these kinds of entities. No neat bow on top.
Definitely no neat bow. So, connecting this story back to those inspector story principles,
yeah,
you can really see a lot of them in play.
Oh, for sure. The grounding is their real place, real time,
yeah.
Tijuana 2005. The mix of a harsh reality, the accident, the funeral costs, with the completely paranormal.
The prayer, the man, his explanation, the grave.
Yeah.
And it uses that eerie imagery effectively. The tall, pale man, the suit, the L, the barren ground, atmosphere over shock.
Definitely. And it follows that slow escalation pattern, too. Strange prayer, sudden tragedy, mysterious benefactor with a chilling reason, then the lingering, accumulating weirdness.
No jump scares, no gore mentioned. It relies entirely on the unsettling idea and all those unanswered questions it leaves hanging.
And crucially, it sticks that landing. No hard conclusion. We're left with the prayer, the word she was the only one, the L, the grave, the mother's ambiguous thought.
It perfectly embodies that idea of ending with a disturbing line or question. Makes you, the listener, do the work. Sit with the unease.
Yeah, you're left trying to piece together possibilities, none of them particularly comforting.
However, thinking about the strictest interpretation of the Inspector Story Guide, there's maybe one slight divergence.
What are you thinking?
Well, the guide really emphasized presenting these things as recovered files, logs, evidence from some kind of archive, explaining the why of the documentation.
Ah, the meta-narrative layer.
Exactly. And this story, She Prayed for the Devil, as we have it here, it doesn't quite have that explicit framing. It's presented more like a straight narrative account.
That's a fair point. It hits many of the stylistic and thematic notes, the ambiguity, the realism, mixed with the paranormal, the unsettling details. It captures the spirit perfectly.
Yeah, the spirit is definitely there.
But that specific framing device, treating it like case file, hashtag XYZ from the Department of Unsettling Occurrences or whatever, isn't explicitly layered onto this particular story in the source material we reviewed.
So it works incredibly well as a story that fits the philosophy, but maybe isn't a perfect example of the full package, including that meta-narrative aspect.
Right. Makes the story compelling on its own, but perhaps missing that final bureaucratic horror layer described in the guide.
Still, it's a really fascinating look at how you can build horror differently. Not on shock, but on atmosphere, implication, psychological discomfort.
Letting the audience connect the strange dots, using ambiguity as a tool, it's horror that kind of seeps in.
Yeah, a subtle corruption of the everyday.
And this deep dive really highlights that craft, doesn't it? Creating unease where the real terror is in what you don't see, what you can't quite understand.
What you only glimpse at the edges. It's about the questions that linger, the feeling that stays with you after it's over.
Thinking about Sophia and that pale man and those principles from Inspector Story about unseen forces and ambiguous beings.
It really leaves you pondering that final unsettling possibility. Host speaker and expert speaker. What if the most terrifying entities aren't those who wish us harm, but those who are simply lonely?